We are today going to cover not only Descartes' arguments for the points that he wants to establish, but we are going to cover the big problem that they created, the big objection that remains to this view to this day. The view that I'm talking about is a view that has been called, and still is called, dualism. D-U-A-L means two. If you write D-U-E-L, then that means your two people are fighting. Dualism. And the dualism here that Descartes is the champion of is one that we call mind-body dualism. Human beings have a mind and a body. That's what constitutes a human being. And human beings in this respect are a microcosm. A little reflection of the big universe around us. Because in the big universe around us, it consists of physical bodies, and they are in space. They are law determined. And they do not think, will, perceive, or know. Human beings have minds, the universe doesn't have a mind, but in addition to rational, to physical bodies, there is the rational component of the universe to which our minds correspond. These are the laws of math, logic, and other axioms that determine, well, that's probably not a good word, but determine our thought, that is, they regulate our thought. Think, will, perceive, decide, believe, and so on. Are not in space. Are not determined. Physical laws. Now, you might say to me, well, that's just a review. We did that stuff last time. Okay, we're getting there. Just a quick reminder. Physical bodies, non-physical minds. The non-physical minds correspond to, know of, think of, the rational order that governs the physical world. M minds are not in space, they're not determined, they're free. Bodies are wholly determined by physical laws and causality. And they do not perceive, will, or feel as minds do. Sounds tiny, but it raises an enormous difficulty. And that enormous difficulty is called the problem of interaction. The problem of interaction. And it is real simple to understand. If my mind is nowhere in space, nothing about it is physical, it's not subject to physical laws or causes, when I make a decision, say, scratch my nose, how does that decision affect my brain and my nerves and then my hand? How does that happen? I mean, think about this. Everything that's true of a mind is false of a body. And everything that's true of a body is false of a mind. Even to the point where the minds aren't in space. So how can a mind that is nowhere and is not connected to the physical brain by any chemical or electrical or mechanical pathways, how does my decision in the mind affect the body? Because there's nothing in common. There's no bridge. Reverse that. Same thing. Something falls on my thumb, cuts it. I feel pain. Now, the cut you can analyze, you can say which nerve ends it cut and so on, and you can trace the nerve pathways up there and up my neck and into my brain, and it produces some kind of brain process that goes on, but the perception of pain isn't the physical motion of brain neurons. How do those brain neurons get a perception of pain into a mind that is nowhere, that is not physical, that is not susceptible to being affected by any chemical or electrical or mechanical causes? How does it get there? This problem has plagued all dualisms, not just Descartes. Plagued dualism before him and plagued them all since him. Getting humans into two tidy pieces and saying one's subject to law and the other is free might sound like a nice way to defend free will. And I agree that free will is the truth there. But is that the way to defend it? The body's completely determined, but the mind is not. It's completely free. Then how does either one of them affect the other? How can either one of them be a cause of what happens to the other? You can't just say causality, right? We're confronted with some kind of causality. All right, does the causality that affects the mind when the body is impacted, is that a physical causality? Well, if it's physical causality, it's not going to affect the mind at all because it's not affected by physical causes and effects. Is it, I don't know, biological? No, that doesn't sound right. That's in space and time. That's subject to change and so on. It's not nowhere and attuned only to the axioms, the rational axioms. How does any causality get across this gap between mind and body? Descartes never answered that. He tried, and he said he couldn't explain that. But he did think he knew where it took place. He said his own proposal was that it takes place in the pineal gland brain. And the only reason he picked that was that the pineal gland is the only organelle in the brain that is not divided symmetrically. It doesn't have two halves. It's unity, and it sits just about in the center of things. So he thought that was where the exchange must take place. It was a guess. And it's easy to laugh at now, but at least it was an intelligent guess at his own time. But knowing where it happens, or the part of the brain that receives the instructions from the mind and passes impulses like pains onto the mind, that's still not saying how this gap is bridged. And Descartes' final verdict, after trying explanation or thinking about it for a long time, the only thing he gives us is this. Interaction is a miracle caused by God. Not very good. I mean, if you have to talk about Deus ex machina, we have a real stinker of a problem here. We don't see any way to solve it. The whole of the dualistic view is going to crash and burn if we can't get some kind of solution here. So we'll drag God in and have him do a miracle. Think about that. That means everybody's perception of the world around them all day, every day. God's constantly making possible by doing a miracle. You know, if that were really true, if it were God making us to see what we see when we look at something, then it wouldn't be a miracle. If that's the way the world works all the time for everybody, all day long, every day, it's not a miracle anymore. And then it makes God's action part of the natural world. That doesn't sound right either. So the problem of interaction was very provocative. And the fact that Descartes essentially gave up on it, okay, it's a miracle caused by God. We could say that about anything, right? For any problem that a philosophical theory runs into, we could say, okay, that's a miracle caused by God. That doesn't sound like a satisfactory explanation at all. And there were other people who came after him that looked at this and came up with other proposed solutions. Take a look at a couple of them. One thinker who liked the dualistic view, but who wasn't satisfied by Descartes' account of interaction, was Malebranche. And sorry, that couldn't come through. It's an E in the end of it. And he held the same kind of dualism and so on, but he held that it's not an overall miracle that God just imparts some miraculous power to all people so that impressions in their minds are passed on to their bodies and impacts on bodies are passed on to their minds, but that so that God's not doing that all day, every day, to everybody, but only on the occasions when it's needed. Occasionalism. Just when there's really no other way it could happen, God steps in and makes it happen. But a thinker who followed him, and Leibniz, thought that this is a bad explanation. And he held that each mind experiences only what takes place in it pre-programmed. Minds so that takes place in them, corresponds to the external world. In other words, why give us such an inefficient theory as to say that God steps in every time it's needed and makes the connection between mind and body? God's got to do that. God is the creator of all minds. Minds know only what's inside them. And what's inside them corresponds to the other minds and what's inside them, the rest of reality, because God's pre-programmed them all so that they're always in harmony. It was called pre-established harmony in his own day. So, in other words, no mind ever perceives an external object. Reality is made of units, and these units are physical and mental. They're both, down to the smallest, tiniest ones, so that there's some amount of mind in everything. And if I get enough of them together, organized into a bigger thing, there's more mind and more consciousness. And finally, you come to human beings and you have a sharp awareness, a consciousness, but only of what's inside the mind. He's not trying to explain an interaction between a purely physical and a purely mental. He's got mental, physical things from the beginning. And God has established a pre-programmed them so that what occurs in the mind reflects what's actually going on in the bodies. Strange view, never quite caught on, but it's another explanation of mind-body interaction that says, in effect, there is no mind-body interaction. There doesn't need to be, because God makes it all occur in the mind as it's occurring outside the mind. And he's pre-programmed them so that there's never a glitch. So perception is reliable, but there's no interaction. I don't know how all this grabs you, but it seems to me that if whatever plausibility Descartes' view had initially gets really stretched beyond believability when these other guys step up and try to answer the difficulty of interaction. Now, how is this viewed today in philosophy? Everyone still admits that, as it was stated, that kind of dualism can't account for the interaction. And I have known distinguished philosophers that live in our own time who say something like this: nobody solved the problem of interaction. They're probably not going to at this point. They've been trying for 400 years and nobody's come up with anything. So we're going to say we can't explain that, all right? But take any other theory of reality. Take idealism that says they're only minds. Materialism says they're only bodies. They have way worse problems than this. So I'm going to be a dualist. I have less that I can't explain than any alternative has that it can't explain. And that's the end of that. There's also a group of people that call themselves Mysterians. And they say that the reason we can't come up with this explanation of the mind-body interaction is the way our brains happen to have evolved. given the way they evolved, either we can't think of the answer, though there is one, or we can. I mean, it's somewhere in our unconscious, but we can't access it. But from there on, they agree that dualism has fewer problems than the other extremes that are usually considered alternatives. Okay. I mean, once again, you could say that about any problem in any theory, right? If it's legitimate to say there, there's no explanation, or it's subconscious and we can't access it, then why can't we say that about any problem that arises in any theory? Oh, well, we can't answer that, but, you know, subconsciously you know it, but we can't bring it up to our conscious level of thought. Then how do you know it's in the subconscious level? Well, don't know. That's my theory. That's the answer I'm giving to these problems. Yeah. Well, that's pretty shaky. By the way, this is the time and place to say that this dualistic theory of a human being, mind, body, whatever is true of mind isn't true of body, and vice versa, so that there's this great gap forms and interaction becomes incomprehensible, got a lot of boost among the people who heard it from their Christian background. Because our scriptures talk about minds and bodies. And our scriptures talk about humans as though they have real freedom. So a lot of people thought, well, you know, Descartes, all he's doing here is putting into philosophy the Christian view of a human being. And I beg to differ, that is not so. Descartes got it wrong. And I'd like briefly to make a comparison and show you where and why I think it's not the Christian view of a human being. For that, we return to my whiteboard. I called it a blackboard, didn't I? Here are the terms that Bible writers use to speak about human beings and their nature. They speak of soul, spirit, and heart. Heart is obviously a metaphor. They knew about hearts that beat and chests, and they're not talking about that. They use the term heart. Now, I'm just reporting to you. I'm a product of a paper I did. I examined every instance of the word heart, soul, and spirit, both in the Hebrew Bible and the Greek New Testament. And this is what I found, that the Bible writers almost always use heart for the central unity of a human being, that person's identity. And there are even places that say it's from the heart that all the other issues come. They use spirit to speak of the diversity of what has its root in the person's heart or self. So they speak of someone of having a spirit of wisdom or a spirit of kindness, a spirit of generosity, or having an angry spirit, that kind of thing. So it's the diversity that comes from the unity. And Bible writers use the word soul in a completely different way than it's come to be used in English. In English, all the way back to very early times, soul is used for what the Bible writers use for heart. But for Bible writers, the soul is the life of the body. It's heart and spirit embodied. So what the way they use that, and given that understanding, the life of the body, which expresses spirit and heart. On that thing, when a person dies, it's exactly the soul that dies. The life of the body dies. So Bible writers don't use the term the way it's come to be used in English. I'd say again, the common meaning of soul is what for Bible writers is a person's heart. The central unity, the identity of a human from which come all the issues of life and all of a person's capacities, inclinations, talents, defects, whatever, has its root and seat in the self, the heart. And the Bible writers do not view that as something that is purely non-physical while the body is purely physical. They view all those as integrated in one another. From a biblical point of view, it is not true that everything true of the heart or self or mind is false of the body, and everything true of the body is false of the heart. No. The heart is more than just physical, but it functions physically, it has physical properties, it exists in space and time, along with a person's body. It is not what Gilbert Ryle ridiculed as the theory of the ghost inside the machine. It's not that the machine collapses, the ghost floats off somewhere else. From a biblical point of view, when a person dies, it's more like having a limb cut off than it's like shedding a shell. The body is not just a shell, and it's not just physical, biological, until a person dies. While they're alive, it's expressive of everything that's in the heart and spirit. So it doesn't see these things as walled off from one another at all. Does it spell out how interaction works? No, but it doesn't place the gaps that need explaining. It doesn't endorse the gaps that need explaining. It has a different sort of view. Am I going to say then that maybe we know what that is, or because our brains evolved, we can't figure out how that is? No, I'm just going to say there are a lot of questions we can raise that we don't know the answer to now, and maybe we'll get answers to some of them when we enter God's final kingdom. Maybe we won't. I've heard preachers in sermons very dogmatically affirm that all the things that puzzle us now will be made clear when we get to heaven. And it occurred to me on the spot that that's a promise that is not anywhere in Scripture. Sorry, Charlie. It's a nice idea, and it may turn out that way. You don't have any reason to think that God's promised that. So I think that the Christian view is significantly different enough that it doesn't raise the problems exactly the way Descartes raises them. It may leave us puzzled about how interaction takes place, but it does not say that the properties and laws that are true of the body are not true of the spirit or heart, and it doesn't do the reverse either. So the body is involved in learning. There's a physical side to it and a non-physical. The heart or the spirit, which includes mind, knows things and understands principles. And the body responds, the same sort of principles organize the body too. I'm not saying a body alone knows anything, but there's no body alone until death. Only then does a body become something only physical chemical, biological. So I would like to disavow us of any position that is going to say that what Descartes has presented us with is the Christian or the biblical position, and that's what doesn't fly. Biblical position may be still vaguer than we'd like on a number of points. We don't know. We don't know how to answer this or that. But it doesn't give us exactly what troubles Descartes' theory. The thinker we cover after Descartes, and I listed these back on the first or second of our talks, the figure who writes the most about this stuff and achieves some attention is a man named Baruch Spinoza. And Spinoza gives an account of human nature that overcomes the mind-body split. But is still very objectionable to most of the thinkers that encounter it. Spinoza is a pantheist. That is to say, Spinoza holds that there is one great reality. And for him, you can call that God or you can call it the world. He doesn't care. And that one great reality is what all the parts that are inside it are made of. So rocks and humans are made of the divine being. And bodies and minds are made of the divine being. So we don't have this rigid gap. He then claims that all things are made of the divine. That's what pantheism means. When our perception is of the two modes in which we can be aware of reality. And they are, guess what? Mind and body. In other words, in our experience, it looks to us as though there are minds and bodies, but really, they are both of the same, ultimately made of the same stuff, the divine being. So rocks and puddles and all that, they're all made of the divine being. When we perceive the world, our perception is such that we grasp it as minds and bodies, and they look like they're opposed to one another, but really behind the scenes, they're all made of the same stuff. So there's no interaction problem. They can interact because it's all the divine being interacting with himself. He doesn't mind whether we call the one reality, the divine reality, God or nature. They're the same thing anyway, right? If everything's made of the divine being, what's nature? The divine being. And then you and I are forced by the limitations of our faculties to see it as mind and body, and we puzzle over how they interact. But that's all solved if you start with his pantheism. So he's a pantheist that he wants his cake and eat it too. He wants everything to all be made of the same stuff, so there's no interaction problem. And then from there on, explain everything as though you're a dualist. We see the world as mind and body, sure. And if you bring up interaction, he resorts to pantheism. And if you bring up objections to pantheism, he resorts to the mind-body dualism. He mainly wrote in ethics, but he wrote enough about theory of reality and knowledge obliquely to give this this much of an account. And then he tried to write an ethics and spell out ethical laws as though they are rational laws. The title of his works was Ethics Done Like Geometry. So he has fundamental definitions and axioms, and then he tries to derive correlates and rules and also and hold that this gives us a system of ethics that's absolutely rigid. It shows us everything that's wrong and everything that's right. Everything that's obligatory for us to do and everything that's obligatory for us to shun and not do. And as countless commentators have said about it, if you concede to him his definitions, then the rest of the stuff would follow, yeah. But there are lots of people who don't agree with those definitions. And he never goes into why they're right or other candidates are wrong. He treats them as though they're the only possible ones. So his philosophy, not all by itself, have a powerful impact on the history of philosophy, how it goes. And this I attribute largely to Christian influence. Jewish too. Jewish and Christian and Muslim influence in civilization. They're all three opposed to pantheism. The creation is not made out of the being of God. God has called creation into existence where previously there was only himself. There was nothing. And nothing is in the name of something out of which God made the world. I mean, there wasn't anything out of which he made the world. God called it all into existence. So it's not favorable to pantheism. And most pantheisms have ended up either with a short-lived popularity or none. Nevertheless, it's interesting to see a guy who takes that kind of tack. He thinks interaction is so severe a problem that he's willing to become a pantheist to get over it. Unfortunately, of course, that didn't go over with the synagogue that he was a member of. He was a member of the synagogue in Amsterdam, and they drummed him out. They tossed him out. You can't tell us God is nature and nature is God and be a Jew. That's what they said to him. So he got the hee-haw. I've already mentioned a little bit about how Leibniz handled this problem. And maybe we will go into more detail about that. I wanted to be sure, though, that this dualistic view of the human being is distinguished from the Christian, that is, the scriptural view of a human being, which is not two things pieced together. And it's not whatever is true of one is false of the other. Is that clear? I was trying to get that. Well, look, take something like memory. Memory is something in the mind. For Descartes, it's going to be only minds have memory and bodies don't. But bodies do have memory, don't they? There's bodily memory. There's that occurs over time. A body's trained to do something. And when someone is injured and their minds are not working rightly, they can still do a certain task because they had habituated themselves. And there was a residual memory in the nervous system of the body. We're not talking about stuff that's purely mental or purely physical, and each of which rule the other out. We're talking about all things, all components of a human, having all kinds of properties, and being subject to all the kinds of laws, even though it's true that the central unit of the heart not only exercises activities that are covered by the laws, but has a center that transcends the laws and is free. It does both. I take that to be the biblical view, and not the Descartes' mutually exclusive entities that have nothing to do with one another, but are somehow unified, or unknown, not unified, combined in a human while they're alive. And by the way, I think one significant piece of support for that is the way that Christian theology, biblical teaching, speaks of humans in after the resurrection. Everlasting life is guaranteed to humans, but it's bodily everlasting life. They are raised from the dead and given a new body that's not mortal. So it's not that there's a mortal body and an immortal spirit. That's called Gnosticism. That's not the New Testament's teaching about this stuff. And I'm endorsing the what I take to be the New Testament view. So we will cover other theorists now in this same era that follow Descartes, that have to deal with interaction, and then we'll take a look, I mean on the continent, and then we'll take a look at the British thinkers that go off on another tack and make their contribution, because it's those two groups that then Kant will come at the end and take the best out of each and try to make a coherent system out of it. Drop the worst, keep the best, put them together, give you what his idea is of the whole picture. I'm not endorsing it. I'm going to be highly critical of it. But those are all treats and goodies yet to come. So do the reading, keep up, review the notes, and I'll see you next time.